Isaiah, think about the prophet Isaiah. Think about the date of writing, the setting, the historical setting of Isaiah, and what comes to mind when set it in the international context. When was Isaiah prophesying?
Seven hundred years before Jesus.
Okay, 700 years before Jesus. That's accurate, but I want to put it in its international context.
Exit.
During the Assyrian Empire, okay? The Assyrian Empire at the time of Isaiah was powerful, but it was beginning to crumble. And the attack that we read about in chapter 7, the Assyrian invasion, ended up with the army of Sennacherib being decimated. And that was the beginning of the end. About 100 years later, they were a nation, an empire no more. They fell. We went through all of that. But they fell to the Babylonians. The Babylonians, Egypt wanted to take power, but Babylon successfully chased Egypt right back down into Egypt, and on the way took Daniel and other men like Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego back into, why do I call them that? Azariah, Hananiah, and Mishael, the Hebrew names, took them back into Babylon. And so Babylon's on the ascendancy. Now, when we get to later chapters, what chapters am I thinking about? Chapters 30, 6 and 37. That's Sennacherib's last stand. In chapter 38 and 39, we see the insertion of the Babylonian threat. And so this is where the book is set. As one empire is descending or beginning its descent, the other empire beginning its arise. Now, what empire hasn't risen yet? Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persian. Medo-Persian. Of course, Rome comes much later, but the Medo-Persian was headed by a guy named Cyrus. And it's really interesting that Isaiah talks about him. Hadn't even born yet. And he talks calls him by name. But we'll get in that very interesting section later. Once we get over to chapter 44, 43, 44, 45, we'll see. Great piece of intrigue going on there. But that's where this book is set. And that the political climate. Hello, Mark. The political climate. You're not done. We're just starting. He's wearing a shirt that says "Done Lumber." Okay. You're going to want to look at these three pages that we've handed out, calling your attention to them. We're just setting Israel or Isaiah in its national intrigue contest. Israel was surrounded by smaller nations, weren't they? Like, can you name a few?
Edom.
Edom, Moab, Ammon, Philistia, Syria, to name a few. These will become prominent once we get into chapter 14, 15. We'll see about them. But I guess what I'm really trying to say is that this book was written to a people who did not live in isolation from world events, from world powers and empires. And the various nations, each nation had its own god or gods, and they attributed their success at war to the power of their gods. They attributed their success at harvest to the power of their god. They attributed their success at having babies to the power of their gods. Everything that pertained to normal life, their gods were in control. Now, what is it that Paul said to the Corinthians? Something like, though there be gods many and lords many, yet for us there is one God and one Lord Jesus Christ. The world has this concept of gods. But the problem with the concept of gods in the world is what? Can you name one major problem? They're not gods.
They're not living.
They're make-believe. They're made up. That we can have statuary and we can have laws, documents that the priest make up, but they're not gods. However, what happened to Israel? What happened to Israel when they, and you can go to Leviticus 26 or Deuteronomy 28. They're like 40 years apart, but they say essentially the same thing. If, the first 14 verses, if you keep my covenant, you'll be blessed, 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 blessed. Verse 15, but if you don't, cursed, 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 cursed. So what nation could overthrow Israel if they were following Yahweh carefully? None. None. But if they failed to follow Yahweh carefully, what nation could overthrow them? Any that had a mighty military. Well, guess what the nation with a mighty military is going to say about their victory? My God, bigger than your God. And so part of the book of Isaiah is to debunk the notion that these gods are to be feared. And when we get to chapter 40, especially, we'll start developing that thought. But I guess what I'm trying to do for you here tonight is to just immerse you into the culture out of which this book was written. Nations all around us, some flexing the muscle, some wishing they could flex their muscle, some having, what do they call it, summit meetings. Two or three kings trying to make an alliance so that they could go against or withstand the Assyrian. We'll see that in chapter 7, for example. And just all the nuance and the intrigue that would take place. And all the while, Isaiah is talking to the people of God about how they are failing to honor him, how they're being superficial about their regard for him, how their culture has deteriorated because of their failure. He's going to have all of these things going on. Okay, so take out the page that says Isaiah outline, two column page, and just look at the two major headings, Roman numeral one, Roman numeral two. One on the left side, two on the right side. Just take a look at those two and make any, don't look at anything below them, just those two, and make any observation you'd like to make. Anybody?
Where are we looking
at? No, you're just looking at the heading. Heading one, heading two. Nothing below those out. What do you see? Anything.
Messiah
on the second half. Okay. Judah and the nations, Messiah and the idols. Okay. Okay.
Rod. Michael.
Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say on your first heading, you're not dealing with the other 10 tribes. They're not in as part of it.
Well, primarily dealing with Judah, because Israel, the 10 tribes are just about wasted, very little, just scrap of an ear, one prophet said. But you guys are making it far more complicated than I wanted you to. The first heading is 39 chapters. The second heading is 27 chapters. Does that ring any kind of bells in your head? 39 and 27? What bell does it ring in your head?
Books.
Yeah, 39 Old Testament books, 27 New Testament books. And the part with the 27 is dealing mostly with Messiah, like the New Testament does. And the part with the 39 is dealing mostly with the nations. And so just an interesting little factoid. And I don't know if it was done that way on purpose, because, you know, when Isaiah wrote it, he didn't write it chapter by chapter by chapter. He just wrote it. And somebody else divided it up into chapters. Sometimes it did a good job, sometimes not so good. But it's just an interesting little factoid that I want you to notice. Okay, now, on the outline of the book, 1A, Judah and Jerusalem's guilt. What we'll have in the first six chapters basically is an introduction to the book and why it was that Isaiah was called to be a prophet. Chapter 6 is Isaiah's commission to be a prophet. And it's just a short little thing, but it's quoted in the New Testament. But it's just, here's the problem. Here's a solution. But it's like an overture. It's like a, who's musical? Who knows what an overture is? You know, an overture, like William Tell overture, for example, or you're going to an opera and they have the overture.
Yeah.
Oh, Jeff.
You
want to
know what it is?
There's.
Oh, you want to know what
it is? I want you to tell everybody what an overture is. I don't care for hummus, but go ahead.
An overture is it's the summation of the whole, the big yeah. Ending.
Well, but it's also sometimes it's at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
And it's a thematic expression of everything that's going to be mm-hmm. in the piece of music.
It's usually big.
Yeah,
right.
Say again.
Rachel says it's the beginning of a bigger piece.
It's the beginning of a what?
The beginning of a bigger piece.
Beginning of a bigger piece, says Alan. What you have in chapters 1 through 6 is kind of an overview, overture of what you're going to find in the book. Israel's sin, their depravity, the last days pouring, not the pouring out of the Holy Spirit, last days establishing in the mountain of the house of Yahweh, where all the nations stream to it. That's chapter 2. And so you have this your overview, but it highlights Israel's or Judah's guilt and why God has to do what he has to do. Even the prophet in Isaiah 6, even the prophet says, I am of unclean lips. I live among a people of unclean lips. And so the angel took a hot coal and put on his lips, here, you're purified. But it's symbolic of just how filthy he saw the nation that he was living among. Okay? So 1 through 6 would be this overture of here are the dramatic things that we're going to find in the book. The next 6, 7 through 12, highlight the coming of the Son. Unto us a son is born, a child is given. Anyway, child and son are mentioned as being given in chapter 9, but in chapter 7, Isaiah's children, in chapter 7 and 8, Isaiah's children were given as signs. And so you have the Assyrian invasion coming, and I will deliver you from that, because there will be a child born who won't even know right from wrong before the kings you're worried about are gone. Well, that was a picture of the virgin birth that would take place when the true deliverance of Israel took place. The deliverance of Israel from the foreign power was one thing. Deliverance of Israel from sin. John 8, everyone who sins is the bondservant of sin. And the servant doesn't remain in the house forever, but if the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. And so set you free from what? Not from the Syrian captivity, not from Babylonian domination, not from the heavy thumb of the Romans. Set you free from sin. John 8, bondservant of sin, set free by the Son. Okay, so we have pictures. So the first 12 is highlight of Israel and Judah and Jerusalem's guilt. Now, exciting stuff in the next section, 13 through 27, judgments against the Gentiles. Isn't that interesting? I mean, just the thought. Judgment against the Gentiles. They didn't have the law of Moses. They weren't under the curse. But they were going to be judged. Nevertheless, and here's an interesting thing. Lindy will enjoy this. When he talked about Egypt, Egypt was judged by Babylon. But in Isaiah 19, he says, Yahweh is coming on a swift cloud. And that, the Babylonian army. Yahweh coming on a cloud is the Babylonian army. So when you're reading the New Testament about Jesus coming on the cloud, we shouldn't think different than the picture that the primer already had, right? If Yahweh coming on a cloud in Isaiah 19 is him riding in on the horses of Nebuchadnezzar, kicking up all the dust, the cloud of dust that would follow them, plus the smoke that would rise from the villages that had been burned as they went through, there's a cloud. They're coming swiftly. That was Yahweh coming on a cloud. Okay. Just keep that picture in mind when you read it in the New Testament and see whether or not the people who are reading the New Testament for the first time would draw a conclusion that is popularly drawn today or whether they draw the one from Isaiah 19. Anyway, what you have, so there's Babylon being judged. But then you have Moab and Damascus and Cush. What's Cush? Cush. It's just below Egypt, isn't it? Cush, Ethiopia might be another name for Cush. Egypt, desert nations, Jerusalem, Tyre. You know, there was an interesting theme, and we'll get to it when we get to it, and I just can hardly wait for that day. But in every one of these, there was some kind of something. These nations, and it was different from nation to nation, that they put confidence in. Tyre, its great economy. The desert nations, the great sand moat. Can you call it a sand moat? They were so out there in the desert that, you know, they're remote, maybe that way. But they put their confidence in their defense. It's just, it didn't work for any of them. You know what? Universally, the admonition of Isaiah was to every one of these, whether it's your economy, whether it's your watery defense, whether it's your strong military, you know what his recommendation was to every single one of them? Come to Zion. Bring your tribute to Zion. Come to Zion. You will find your refuge in Zion, not in your economy, not in your military, but in Zion. So fascinating section there. Now, 24 through 27 is even more fascinating. 24 through 27. Mike, do you know what 24 through 27, the code name some people give that, those four chapters? Okay. Anybody? The little apocalypse.
Yeah.
It's the condensed form of the book of Revelation. And it talks about how that the earth, the land of Israel, who lived under the covenant which they broke, was going to be destroyed. There's a wedding feast in there. And so it's just, there's resurrection in there. Not bodily corpses out of the ground, but spirits coming back to life to God. So it's referred to as the little apocalypse, and it shows God's restoration all these nations in 13 through 23 who would come and find their solace in Zion. Here's what I'm going to do for Zion. Okay. So 24 through 27 follows that up. He looks at Zion as it was, not as it was going to be, but as it was, situated among the nations. And chapter 28 through 31 have five different woes that God pronounced against his people. Woe against the leaders who were scoffing, a woe against heartless religion. What's a heartless religion?
Action without any.
Yeah, go through the motions. We're supposed to sacrifice us. We sacrifice that. We're good. We're supposed to go to church on Sunday. We go to church on Sunday. We're good. But no heart given to God, just going through the motions. You'll find that there in chapter 29, making plans without consulting Yahweh, making foreign alliances, making putting your reliance upon a foreign power, buying their protection rather than looking to God. So Israel was in deep doo-doo. But he can't help it. He just can't help it. He comes back and he talks about the future glory of Zion. Here's what it's going to be like when we take care of all this stuff. So, 32 through 35. Pardon?
Rod, you said buying alliances with foreign countries. Yeah. Is that anything like buying insurance?
No. No, it's paying a foreign army to come and help you. It's not buying in. They thought they'd get buying insurance, but it's different. It's paying for the armies to come in and fight your battles. What do we call that?
Mercenaries.
Mercenaries. Yeah, there you go. Only this was on a national level. On a national level. But 32:3, 4, and 5 just paint a beautiful picture of a garden blooming because the Spirit is poured out upon the people. Using the picture of an arid space that gets watered to illustrate what happens when God would pour out his Spirit upon his wilderness. And that kind of gives some teeth to the idea of John the Baptist came preaching where? In the wilderness. Now, it was out in the deserted areas, but the illustration was, my people are not bearing my fruit because they don't have my word in their life. And so they were the wilderness. All right. Then what you have in 36 through 39, you can find also in the book of Kings. It's the historical record of Sennacherib's invasion, Sennacherib's failure, King Hezekiah showing Babylon all of his goods, and Isaiah saying to him, you know, they're going to come in and take all of these goods 100 years from now. But that's what you have there in 36 through 39, the descent or the collapse of Assyria and the ascendancy of Babylon. Just the historical record. Okay, any thoughts? That's column A, Roman numeral 1. The first two-thirds of the book. Not quite two-thirds, but close. No thoughts? Again, I'm either doing so good that you don't have any questions, or I'm doing so poor that you don't have any questions. Jen, you shouldn't laugh at me like that.
Rod?
Yes.
Yes, Mike. The only thing that I would suggest, if you could, is that a lot of times when the writer is writing, he is writing and uses different forms of language, like covenantal language. There are certain words that are in covenantal language as well as judgmental language. You know, the evidence of the law, the judgment of things. And so you can tell.
That's just a little deeper than I wanted to go in this in this overview, Michael. But you're right.
Okay.
But I should have covered that last week. Pardon?
That's what I'm sharing, because I think it's probably too deep.
Yeah.
I just love that part, though, about all these nations that God had plans to bring them in way back then.
Oh, yeah. That's a really good catch. Even back in the days of Isaiah, he's telling the foreign nations, you ought to look to Zion. It's not just Israel that ought to look to Zion. The foreign nations ought to look to Zion. That also tells me something, that Zion, and it's when it says in chapter 2 that all nations would flow to the mountain of the house of the Lord, and they would learn the law of God. And here the nations are invited to come. That suggests to me that it's just a suggestion, and you might develop it and play with it. But there is a notion in the world today that once Jesus died on the cross, everybody, the whole world, universal salvation, and that can't possibly be. Here, there's the idea of they have to come. They have to come. I, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to myself. They have to come, okay? The second one is that famous R word that's used throughout the prophets of the amount of people that God would have left from his nation, and according to Zechariah 9, from the Philistines at least. What's that R word I'm thinking about? Remnant.
Remnant.
Remnant. Remnant. What's a remnant? A piece of. The leftover, pardon, an ending, the cut off chunk. Okay, some got cut off and thrown away, or used what, however, and some got cut off, and so God refers to the people he saves as his remnant, the remainder.
Do we have very many examples of foreign nations that were blessed before Christ by turning to God?
The one that really jumps out at me is Naaman. Naaman, mighty, mighty, mighty man. He was the
general.
Well, the second in command almost. The one who, when the king of the emperor of Assyria went into his temple to worship, he would go in and lean on the hand of Naaman. That's how important he was. And after he was healed from his leprosy and realized the power of the God of Israel, wanted to give gifts. The prophet wouldn't take them. Gehazi got greedy and he took some, and he got the leprosy for his efforts. But Naaman said, can I at least take 2 donkey loads of dirt back with me? I want the soil of the God of Israel so I can make. He didn't say why. I construe that he wanted to make some kind of shrine, some kind of, this is the soil of the only true God. And then he said something very important. He says, I have to be at the hand of my Lord the King when he goes in to worship his pagan God. Please, please forgive me. You know what the prophet said? Go in peace. And so I that story is included for the purpose of showing that, yeah, this one true God appealed to more than just Israel. He was appealing to, I firmly expect to see both Naaman and Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, what did he do after chapter 5 of Daniel? This is the only God there is that can do this. I firmly expect to see him there as well. As brutal as he was early, he became a believer, a firm believer, a devoted believer in the one true God. Now, that's just my belief. Okay, you may disagree. But yeah, we don't see a lot, but we see enough to say it happened, of foreign nations. Now, it's never been the case. Never been, not even with the United States of America, has never been the case that a nation was the nation of God. Well, they were a tribe. They were a family, a clan. Okay, they weren't a full nation. They were just a clan. Now, there can be some very faithful people in a nation, but Israel is a prime example. It started out as God's nation, but how did it end up? Destroyed. Yeah, if Israel can't do it with the world's most perfect law, then no nation.
Led by God.
Yeah, and then no nation, can't. No nation can do it. Every nation needs Jesus. So, okay, that was an interesting detour. Great, great detour. But we come then to the second section, Messiah and the idols. You see, the idol was more than just a worship focal point to Israel. It was also dread. Because if the idol, the God, the idol represented the God, right? The idol was not a God, it represented the God. But it was treated like it was, and honored and feared and revered, all of those things. But that God has subjected us. We're afraid of him. When we get to chapter 40, God says, what are these? They're just like a drop from a bucket compared to me. Who will you compare to me? Is the major question, chapter 40, which kicks off the section about him among the idols, 40 through 48. Who are you going to compare me to? Who are you going to compare to me? Many challenges come up in here. Like, is that nation, their system, can their gods, is there any record that you can go back in history and say, their gods predicted that this would happen? Okay, now you, Israel, you are my witnesses. You know what I said, and you've seen what I've done. So he says, compare what I said in the past to what's happened already. See if their gods could, if there's any record where their gods said what was going to happen. You know, that's a very dangerous thing to do. There's a piece in here where God says, Isaiah says, causing the omens of the boasters to fail and confirming the word of his servants. So you've got this God behind the scenes, the only true God there is, and you've got these pretenders saying, this is what's going to happen. And God says, nope, ain't going to happen that way. Causing the boasting, the omens of the boasters to fail. I cause it to fail, but I confirm what my spokesmen say. He's asking Israel to put the system to a test. He said, not only that, but let's start from right now. Let's start from right now, have a contest right now. And you let your boasters say what's going to happen. And then, oh, by the way, did you know that 200 years from now, a man named Cyrus is going to have my temple rebuilt? I mean, what, boldly, brazenly, out in print. God says, I will rise to the challenge I'm asking you to put them to. You ask them to tell you what's going to happen in the future. I'm telling you right now what's going to happen in the future. Cyrus is going to have that temple built. Cyrus hadn't even born yet. Wouldn't be born for another 150 years. And the Medo-Persians weren't even the power yet. The Babylonians weren't even the power yet. And God answered his own challenge. So, in chapter 45, he says to Cyrus, I've called you by name for three reasons. Number one, so you can know that I'm the one that called you. Number two, to do something special for my people Israel. Number three, so that men from the rising to the setting of the sun. Now, pause there. How far is that? How far is from the rising to the setting of the sun? How far is east from the west?
You can't measure it.
It's all the way.
There is no end. There's no end. Now, if you say how far is the north from the south, you can go so far north, and now you're going south. And then you're going north again, and now you're going south. And so you can have limbs. But east to the west, there's no limb. He says, so that men might know from the east, from the rising of the sun to its setting, that there is no God but me. That's why I called you by name, Cyrus. And he said that to him 200 years before he was even did what he did in 150 years before he's even born. And so we have this contest that God said, my people are wrapped up and they don't know who to believe. I'm going to give them a simple test, a simple illustration of how do you know who to believe? How do you know who's truly God? And so what's part of that simple test is really exciting because it has to do with what he was going to do for Israel through Messiah. And that's just really exciting stuff. Okay? And so the second section, 49 through 59, is Zion being called to be righteous. Hello, Dallas. Zion being called to righteousness. There's good news of deliverance. There's something really special. Chapter 52, somewhere around verse 16, he says, what did he say?
Yes. I don't want to talk about anything. I'll probably have to do that. Okay.
Mike, I really, really like this passage. It just resonates with me. Isaiah 52, 16. No, that's the wrong one. 51:16. Because I have put my words, as he always speaking, I have put my words in your mouth, and I have covered you with the shadow of my hand to establish the heavens, to found the earth, and to say to Zion, you are my people. The message of Isaiah was for the purpose of establishing the new heavens and the new earth, God's new people. That's just, when that dawned on me, and I told you once, didn't I, that I went through the book about three different times of teaching it. And I saw this something, it's like a mist covered, shrouded in mystery thing that was there, and I couldn't bring it into focus. Second time I went through, it was a little clearer. The third time through, I said, that's what it is. He's talking about the new messianic order. He called it the new heavens and the new earth. He called it the mountain of the house of the Lord. He called it my people. He called it Zion. He called it New Jerusalem. He called it all those things. But it's messianic people. What God had in store. And it's just jumped off the page at me. And so the restoration of Zion back to the glory that God intended for her to have. So if that's going to be the case, then there's going to be a call to people, be righteous. Follow me. And so there's a call to righteousness. And then we close the book, chapters 60 through 66, talking about the future glory of Zion. 65 and 66, there's a new name and a new people and a new way of worshiping God. And it's in the new heavens and new earth. You know, that phrase is used sparingly in the book of Isaiah, but it's used. And so when you read in 2 Peter 3, for example, verse 13, where Peter says, according to promise, we are looking for new heavens and new earth wherein righteousness dwells. Peter was talking about this. He's saying, we're looking for that. By the way, Peter was looking for it to happen almost immediately when he wrote 2 Peter 3. So that's what we're anticipating, that what Isaiah promised is about to emerge. Are you familiar with the time stamp statements in the book of Revelation? Beginning and end. Okay? Several in the first couple chapters, several in the last couple chapters. Universally, or without waiver, they say what? Coming, I am coming quickly. I'm coming soon. I'm about to come. When John wrote the book. And what did John see coming down out of heaven? The New Jerusalem, or
a bride
adorned for her husband, the church, the new heavens, the new earth. Right? And so what we see promised here in 65 and 66 Peter and John saw right on the verge of taking place when they quit writing. So that's what we're looking at in the book of Isaiah, a major, massive theme, but a very simple theme. I am your God. I'm the only one who can save you. I mentioned the three things that God wanted Cyrus to realize. So, again, it's 45, because I called you by name in order, verse 3, in order that you might know that it is I, Yahweh, the God of Israel, who calls you by name. Verse 4, for the sake of Jacob, my servant, I've called you by name. I'm going to do something for Jacob. And verse 5, I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you have not known me, that men may know from the rising to the setting of the sun that there is no one beside me. I am Yahweh, and there is no other. What do you suppose the point of all that was? Thoughts? He wrote it to Cyrus. But what's the point of it? So that men might know from one end of the earth to the other that there is no God but Yahweh, the God of Israel. There is no God. I mean, if I can look at the fulfillment of that promise and say, well, it really did happen just the way he said, what conclusion must I draw? Well, I don't know. Maybe some of the gods maybe Buddha really is something special, or maybe some of the gods of what's that place? India, Hindu. How many gods does India have? 300,000, maybe. And then you said, how do I weed through all those?
Cyrus, and then it happens.
See how easy that was? I don't have to weed through all those and say, I'll put that, test that guy, test. No. He said, Cyrus, you're going to do this for me. Read Ezra 1 and see what Cyrus thought about that. Cyrus, you're going to do this for me. So that men from the one end of the heavens to the other end of heavens can know that there's only one God. There's only one God. There's only one God. Not all these idols that you're afraid of that are scattered around you. And the reason that you're being oppressed is not because their gods are bigger than yours. It's because you're not faithful to your God, the only one that can help you. So major, major stuff here in the book of Isaiah. Now, I want to spend just a little bit of time telling you about this sheet right here. It looks very complicated, but actually it's quite simple. Column left hand, general outline, is the outline we just went through just now. It's the two major points and the three and four subpoints under those two major points. So you go to the other side, the right-hand side of the page, and what you'll find there is the, point one is the same as point one, Judah among the nations, but point A is the same as point A. But then what you have underneath point A is the expansion of the outline of those 12 chapters, and that's it. And you can't see it. It didn't. I should have either done it in a different color or a little darker gray. But the section that we're in is grayed out. There's just a tad bit of gray. And I'm sorry, you can't see it. But Judah and the nations has like a 10% gray behind it. Judah and Jerusalem's guilt, point A, has a 10% gray scale behind it. And Judah's guilt, number one, has a 10% gray behind it, but the rest don't. And that's to identify where the section that we're looking at, see this part down here, where it fits in the book as a whole. And When we get into chapter 40, the left-hand column will be identical, but the right-hand column will change. It'll be the section that we're in, and it will be who rather than one. It'll say Messiah and the idols rather than Judah and the nations, and then there'll be point A, but it won't be Judah and Jerusalem's guilt. It will be his superiority over the idols when we get there. Okay, and I'll have these for you every time we go into a new section. This one you're going to work with me on for the next several weeks until we finish chapter 6. Any thoughts on that? Any questions? What I said makes sense.
Rod?
It really works well for me to help me identify where I am in the book. This section I'm studying right here fits, and I can see it on the right-hand side, the general outline, and I can see it on, I mean, the left-hand side. I can see it on the right-hand side, the specific spot in the where we are. So it helps me. Maybe it'll help you. Maybe you'll say, well, that's a lot of work for nothing. I don't know, but it helps me. Now, go ahead.
Isn't most of Isaiah essentially just like a very detailed expansion of what Moses said?
Most of the prophets are. Do you have that? Yeah. You have that paper that I put out on the connections to Deuteronomy 32? You probably do.
I mean, I probably do somewhere.
Or you probably have made up your own. Yeah. Yeah. But what Mike is saying is right. The prophet's preaching text was always Moses. They are making promises about the future, but they're just expanding on the promises Moses made about the future. But primarily, they're saying, you guys are guilty because, and pointing right back to Moses. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Now, quickly, this sheet here, the major themes. Ain't no way we're going to cover that, but I want you to have it, because Isaiah will be taking thoughts and weaving them throughout his book. For example, you talk about the highway. Just look at, there's three verses that I picked up on that talked about the highway. One's in chapter 11, one's in 19. And the last one's in 49. What does that tell you? Just that piece of information there. 11, 19, 49. No, you don't have to. There's something that you can extract just by looking at it. They're in the two different sections, right? And so a theme that perhaps connects the book together, beginning to end. It's not quite to the end, but you could look at the way and do the same thing. You got it way down in chapter 62. But think about this. What did Jesus say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the way. There is a way, and I'm it. Where would we read about the way? Well, Isaiah talked about it. Okay. I am the way, the truth, and the light. Notice that there is a very prominent theme of light, and light as contrasted with darkness. Now, the darkness, when we get to end of chapter 8, the darkness was the despair of being oppressed by the foreign nations and not having God in their life. And then chapter 9 says, the people who dwelt in darkness saw a great light. Guess where that's quoted? Matthew 4, talking about the preaching ministry of Jesus. So it was the oppression, but it was the oppression of sin. The oppression of being subdued and subjugated by a foreign power. But it was really an illustration of the oppression of sin. And Jesus was the light. And Isaiah deals with thus the light and the darkness. Water. What good is water? If you water your garden,
you can't live without it. Things grow.
You water your garden, what happens? It grows. You could even the damming of the Columbia River project was in large part to irrigate the desert land around Moses Lake and in that area. And if you ever fly over, you'll see these great big green circles from the irrigation. Why are they green and everything else is brown? Why are they growing stuff and the other stuff isn't? What's the water? But in chapter, what is it, chapter 35, it was the pouring out of the Spirit. The pouring out of the Spirit that was compared to the water. And so that's a theme that Isaiah has. You can connect the wilderness to that, and we already talked about that. John came preaching in the wilderness. Major theme is Zion, the new heavens and the new earth, the mountain of Yahweh's house. And then the son, the child, David, the branch, the shoot, the standard, the signal, the covenant. These are all interrelated in one person. Jesus was given as a covenant. He was the offspring of David. He was the shoot, the branch, who was the child. Unto us a child is born, a son is given. And that's a major theme of God bringing a son of David to be the Messiah. And then we talked about the remnant and survivors, God's sons. You can see that there on that last little bit. And then witness. Isaiah is pretty heavy on the idea of witness. What's a witness? I mean, what's the purpose of a witness? Can I get a witness?
To give account.
To testify what I've seen or what I've heard or what I've read. Okay. When he said, now there's a religious group that calls themselves Jehovah's Witnesses based on a statement in the book of Isaiah. I think they missed the point of Isaiah's statement. He said to the entire nation of Israel, you're my witnesses. Witnesses of what? Talked to you about this already. No? Of predictions. What I said was going to happen. You're witnesses that I said it. And here it is. You're my witnesses. You're the one that can testify. This is what God said. And here it is.
Last heaven and earth.
Pardon?
Including the witnesses back to heaven and earth. That's what Moses basically condemned, not condemned them, but basically said heaven and earth is going to be a witness against these things. And then lists all those things.
Yeah, but that's, there is some esoteric connection. But the idea is of witness here is those who could validate and verify this is what God said was going to happen. Okay. So that's all I have for you tonight. Next week, we're going to look at the first 20 verses of chapter 1. But I still want you to read 1 through 6 every week. 1 through 6. By the time we finish chapter 6, you'll know it so well that you'll be ready to push on. Verse 7 through 12. Any final thoughts?